Sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood. Others may deceive you. You decide what's good. You decide alone, but no one is alone. This is the space of honor. Honor, the space of conscience and principle. When you're halfway through the wood and you feel that you must go alone your own way, you decide for yourself what is good. What's your sense of honor telling you to do? But that decision, what is good, it can feel like you make it by yourself. You search your own heart, your own mind, it can feel that way. But no one is ever really alone. We carry with us into the difficult moral moments of our lives the wisdom and the honor codes of others, what Kwame Appiah calls our honor world, our peers, the people we respect and whose respect we value. Our honor world, we carry their values with us so that halfway through the woods, when we don't know where to turn and what to do and who to disappoint, we think, what would my minister do? You're supposed to laugh at that. It's okay. So maybe you don't think that. I suppose maybe some of you do think that, which I will tell you used to frighten me. You know, the idea that people were following my example, not just my words, but my example, terrifying. Then I had children. And the idea that you all will learn your honor code in part from me is far less terrifying than the sure and certain knowledge that my children will. That's pressure. I know that they will, because when I confront a hard choice, a moral dilemma, I sometimes think, what would my dad do? He's part of my honor world. His moral code, to be generous with friends and family, but simple in your own living, to tell the truth as you see it, and to work hard, this code is embedded into me. If I'm confronting a hard moral choice, I rarely get on the phone and say, Dad, what should I do? But that doesn't mean that I'm alone, for that honor world is with me, no matter where I go. It is this concept of Kwame Appiah's of an honor world, a social sphere of moral understanding that really captured my attention as I was preparing this message. Appiah, a philosopher at Princeton, gives examples when the content of what was honorable changed. And those changes became moral revolutions. The foot binding of women in China used to be a source and a sign of honor. But within a few decades around 1900, the social elite became embarrassed by the practice and convinced each other to stop, not to do it to their daughters and not to let their sons marry anyone whose feet were bound. And foot binding became not a source of pride, but a source of shame. It went from being honorable to being dishonorable, and it stopped like that. Something like that, Appiah says, also happened to end dueling between gentlemen. You know, walk 20 paces, turn around, shoot at each other with an old pistol. It went from being dignified to being ridiculous. And slave owning from being the honorable sign of the rich and powerful to being a source of shame and dishonor for the whole nation. You want to change something, change the meaning of honor. Change who has honor, and you change the moral equation. I thought of marriage equality as I was reading the book. Just a decade ago, people could speak of honoring marriage in this country by keeping same-sex couples out. And some people still think that way. But now most of us will say that we honor marriage and we honor love by including all who wish to be part of the institution. That's what honor requires. You want to fight against income inequality? Don't tell people that it's unfair or unjust. They already know that. Just like they already knew that foot binding was cruel and slavery was cruel, they already know that. Convince them that it's dishonorable, shameful, and embarrassing. That's how Teddy Roosevelt did it, and that's how we'll end today's Gilded Age. That's how Jim Crow ended. You flip who has honor. What does it mean to be honorable? Who is the man here? McCarthyism ended, some of you remember the moment, it ended in the exact instant that Joseph Welch said to the senator, "At long last, have you no sense of decency?" Remember? Some of you do. When it was McCarthy, not the supposed communists, who was without honor, the witch hunt was over like that. Honor is a force for moral change that works because of this notion of an honor world, that there are people who we respect who want us, who we want to respect us, people whose honor codes matter to us, who we incorporate into our lives and our hearts and our minds. When you think of a literal honor code, you probably think, as I do, of a college or a boarding school, perhaps a military academy, and the honor code is memorized by everyone, and you better not break it. Thus, all the students are part of the honor world, a common sense of what is just and right. And the expectation is that you will follow the code not just when you are in class or even only when you are on campus, but that you'll follow it wherever you are, even when you are alone, for no one is really ever alone. You bring this honor world, this moral strength and clarity with you wherever you go. So for me to ask you the question, what's your honor code? Well, it presupposes a first question. Who is in your honor world? Whose respect do you seek? When you ask, what would so-and-so do? Who's so-and-so? Whose life is your moral text? Not just individuals, but communities. What traditions, what teachings, what set of principles make up your honor world? The people who make up your honor world are often going to be the people who inspire you, who've comforted you in sorrow, and have given you hope in times of despair. Chrysanthemum, despite her parents' love and affirmation, was feeling alone and was ready to surrender herself to the moral code of the mean girls in school, to become Jane, to wilt and fade. But the music teacher offered another view of honor, to be fully yourself, to celebrate your fabulousness. And her vision of honor, of the good and joyful life, was far more compelling, so compelling that all the mean girls switched over to the new honor world. That's whose respect they wanted. Often, however, our sense of honor doesn't come from another. It comes from something inside ourselves. At least that's the way it feels. "Now I become myself," writes the Universalist poet May Sarton. "Now I become myself, feel my own weight and destiny. I, the pursued who madly ran, stand still and stop the sun. Now I become myself." The discovery of your true honor code, what, though society yells and shouts and distracts and obscures, what is your sense of honor? To live deliberately, to go into the woods and sit with your own conscience, to make a true account of life and the world and publish it for the world, to return with a sense of what is in the end honorable to you. For both May Sarton and for Henry David Thoreau, this moment, "Now I become myself, now I go into the woods," is the fulcrum of their lives. The time when they take the values of their upbringing, their society, and lay them aside for something else, something more true, something more authentic to their beating and living heart. Developing an honor code isn't just about who you follow. It's a dance, a back and forth, a dialectic, to use the philosophical phrase, between the social, peer values of your upbringing and the more mysterious internal sense of right and wrong, of purposes, of your purpose and love. There are forerunners. There are revolutionaries, the ones who are the first to poke their heads out, to say, "No, foot binding isn't honorable. It's shameful. Slavery isn't honorable. It's shameful." The one who breaks away from their code of the code of their parents, their neighbors. Some of you have done this, I know. You grew up in honor worlds that you now have at least in part rejected. Honor worlds that excluded some people, maybe you yourself, because of their sexuality, their race, their creed, or their social station. And now you have a new honor code. Maybe you learned it from someone, a teacher, but chances are, and I've heard you say this, chances are that you had a sense in your own heart growing up that the honor code that you grew up with wasn't quite right. And you fought against it, or you rebelled, or you withdrew. And when you found others who agreed with you, when you found an honor world that made sense, that corresponded with your own growing sense of what was true and right, and maybe it was when you came to this church for the first time, maybe that was the day when that happened, and you felt a sense of relief and liberation and joy. I'm not alone. I thought I was alone here in these woods, but I'm not. These people are my people, and they see honor the way that I do. Even if we don't use the word honor to describe it, they value love more than rules and inclusion more than propriety. Our honor world, once we find it, often feels like joining the tribe. It can be so core to our identity and our sense of what we are about and what our lives are for. But, and this is important, but even when we are in an honor world that fits us pretty well, there's a space for the individual conscience to keep testing and exploring and pushing the edge to see, are we valuing the right things? This is something we Unitarian Universalists do pretty well. As David talked about last week, the part of our tradition that we honor most is that revolutionary, prophetic trailblazers, the leaven, not the bread, the Sartons and the Thoreaus who ask hard questions and upset the apple cart, who go into the woods and ask, what is life for? What is love? What is truth? What is justice? And they come back with their answers. It's a dance, a back and forth. Even in an honor world that fits pretty well, it's a back and forth between the values of our peers and our own heart's truth. What's your honor code? Who's in your honor world? Let me tell you a little bit about mine, just as an example. My own honor world includes, as I said, my dad and his humble generosity, my sister and her ecological commitment, my mom's inclusive pluralism, my teachers, like Chrysanthemum's music teacher, who encouraged creativity and learning. But my honor world mostly is made up of my friends, and most of my friends are other Unitarian Universalist ministers. Their respect matters to me, because I respect them. I seek their advice and try to do what I think they would do. Not that they always agree with each other. This is important. An honor world doesn't always have conformity. Some of my friends, my colleagues, are vegans as a matter of honor, and some like locally raised meat. Some live with deep simplicity as a matter of honor. Others think that such self-denial dishonors their work and their families. Some believe that honor demands a reverence for God. Others have concluded that honoring humanity leaves little to no space for such an idea. They don't always agree, yet they are my honor world. Often among them, there is a kind of rough consensus, not a set of rules or doctrines or do this or that, though we do have a set of professional rules here and there, but it's more intangible. It's about the way that you carry yourself in the world. The honor world that I'm a part of, these Unitarian Universalist ministers and the radical tradition that informs our lives, this honor world isn't so much a set of rules as it is an ongoing conversation. It's not about what we agree on. It's about what we talk about. What does it mean to be authentic and to follow your heart? What does it mean to love mercy and do justice and walk in the spirit of love? What does it mean to respect the dignity of every person? What does it mean to be part of the web of life? What does it mean to say yes to truth and life and love? To care about honor in my mind is not to adhere to a set of rules. In the end, I side with the older monk in the old story. It's not about the code. It's about the person in front of you, the ability to live in the moment, and be compassionate. To care about honor, in my mind, is to attend to the conversation about what is worthy and what is shameful. To care about honor is to ask yourself, what is honorable? It doesn't mean you always know the answers. It doesn't mean that. But we all know people who don't even ask the question, don't we? They might ask what is expedient, or what is popular, or what is pleasurable, but they don't ask what is honorable. When you are halfway through the woods, you feel alone, but you're not. You're part of a community of conversation, an honor world, a set of lives and examples that you carry in your heart, at least you can be. Then you know, with your brother in your heart and your sister in your song, that you can go on. Easy moral decisions don't require much of an honor code. When it's obvious, when it's simple, you don't need a code. Don't lie, don't kill, don't cheat. That's often enough. And if the world would be better if folks did that more often. But when it's hard, when it's complicated, the simple honor code often doesn't work. How do you navigate between two competing goods? How do you choose when someone will be hurt no matter what? What is worthy of being sacrificed for the sake of something more important? These are questions that are not resolved with words on paper. They require honest conversation, a consideration, and a discernment. And sometimes we're going to get it wrong. And so they require a sense of grace and forgiveness. Pete, in his chalice lighting, reminded us that the spirit of this church is to ask questions and to explore, to not take anything blindly. This is the work of honor. We say yes to life and love and truth, but we have to ask ourselves, what does that mean in this time and place? And we ask that question not by ourselves, but with either literally or imaginatively with others who make up that conversation, that honor world for us. We become ourselves by looking inward and outward, by doing that dance back and forth. We hold the answers that we find with loose grip, knowing our words and our concepts only point in the general direction of truth and do not capture it. To paraphrase and slightly amend that great line from The Princess Bride, life is complicated. Anyone who says otherwise is selling something. Honor is complicated. Moral choices are complicated. The more important it is, the less clear the answers will often appear. Our community of conversation, our honor world, will help us navigate these difficult choices. But we must take their wisdom in the right spirit, not always the exact rule, more the general direction. Asking the right questions before we ask, will this action produce a story about which later we will be proud to tell, or about which we will be ashamed? Will this earn us the respect of those who we ourselves respect? It is the spirit of questioning, of wondering, and discovery that should and must animate our codes of honor. Never a static set of rules, but instead a way of life, and a community of conversation, a horizon of possibility. Some folks reject the notion of honor altogether, antiquated and unhelpful, they say, but I hope that you have discovered this month, as I myself have, that honor is a rich concept, that it is an invitation to self-discovery. What honor demands isn't obvious, but we know the general shape. A concern, first of all, for the person before us, an expansive and inclusive vision of love, the spirit and the deeds of the prophets of history, not the veneration of their lives, a community of conversation whose ongoing dialogue helps us become ourselves, and the voice of our own soul, our own heart, what some but not all of us call the voice of God within, our conscience. These things put together can make up a robust and dynamic sense of honor, a code by which each of us would be proud to live our lives and to come in our time to the end of our days and say, yes, we said yes as best we could, whether alone or with others, we said yes to truth, to life, to love. And we did it with honor. Let's sing together. Just as long as I have breath, the words are up here on the screen. It's number 6 in your gray book. Please rise in body and or in spirit.